The Church of God the Eternal presents the 10th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, July 19th, 2025.
Well, I'm going to continue on this series concerning the survey of the books of Samuel. The 10th message already in this series, and so far we're at least maintaining the pace of the average of one sermon per chapter, because we are in the middle of chapter 10 and this is the 10th sermon, so I feel pretty good about that pace, and that's going to be my goal throughout the rest of it, which just tells you with all the chapters in the books of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, this is going to be a rather long series. So very happy for the feedback and a number of you who have expressed your interest in this topic, in this material, and the satisfaction with what you have told me in personal feedback seems to be a benefit. So I'm very happy for the chance to cover it. Last time, if you will recall, we covered all of 1 Samuel chapter 9, and then all the way through the first 16 verses of chapter 10, we saw that Saul was chosen by God to be the king of Israel. God set up the circumstances by which he was introduced to the prophet Samuel for the first time. And then before departing, then Samuel, by God's instruction, laid hands upon Saul and anointed him to become king. And I think I mentioned to you before, you know, that wasn't the end all be all. We had the anointing of Saul. We've got then today we're actually going to cover the second, if you want to say, formal event around the selection of Saul as king, and then there's going to be another one, even that we'll cover next time. So it's like three different ones, and you might say, well, why was not the anointing by God the end of it? And my answer is because there is a factor concerning the people. So it's one thing, and remember, we read Saul basically anointed, or Samuel anointed Saul in private. So no one else was around. He sent the servants on beyond, and then Samuel laid hands upon Saul in private. So it's not a public thing yet. And what's Saul going to do? He's going to come out and say, oh, by the way, everybody, I've been anointed to be your king. Here I am. So God orchestrated this whole thing in a way, literally to make a big splash, if you will, with the Israelites of the day. And they're carnal people, and they certainly wanted evidence of it. So we're going to see some factors involved in the whole initiation of the establishment of a new human king over Israel for the first time, and then how that plays out. So we saw the beginning of that last time. After that anointing, then Saul returns to his home. Samuel instructs him then within 7 days to meet him in the city of Gilgal out to the east. So then after this, now we're going to pick it up in 1 Samuel 10 verse 17 to continue the story, where we're going to find that Samuel then calls a major national gathering. And the question is, for what purpose? Well, we're going to find out. So verse 17 here we read, and Samuel called the people together unto the Eternal to Mizpah. Mizpah, the city or village of Mizpah, most likely about 8 miles north of Jerusalem, just to try and give you some geographic context if you care about that stuff. About 8 miles north of Jerusalem in the territory of Benjamin. Now, so remember, Saul and his family were Benjamites. And so this meeting is actually taken place in the territory of the Benjamites, which probably was not by accident at all. And notice Samuel is not calling this gathering of the entire nation according to for his own purposes as a judge. Remember, he was still a judge over Israel. He's not calling it in his own name. He's actually using the name of God to call this assembly, because he says he called the people together unto the Eternal. So he called this as a meeting place. Now, it doesn't say this was around the time of an annual holy day, and no indication that it was. But he was calling them literally to appear before God, because you're going to find out something miraculous is going to happen during this meeting that actually involves the presence of God. Verse 18, and And said unto the children of Israel, thus saith the eternal God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt. So in the name of God, Samuel is speaking to these people. And what you find during this whole passage is Samuel is reminding them of their lack of faith and the disrespect that they originally showed to God by asking for a human king. And so we've already seen it. We saw it last time. We see him repeating it now. Now, it's like he's saying, you're getting what you asked for. You're going to get a human king, but don't ever forget that this was an act of rebellion and an utter disrespect for your God. So here again, that history is being repeated, and in fact, you're going to find it's repeated again, I think in chapter 11 that we'll cover next time. I brought up Israel out of Egypt, he says in the name of God, and delivered you out of the land of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all kingdoms and of them that oppressed you. Meaning they were the beneficiaries of a powerful king. God was their king who created these miracles to make them a nation and to bring them out with a high hand and to grant them all of these great things. Verse 19, and you have this day rejected your God, who himself... So not even through a proxy like Moses or Joshua or anyone else. Samuel is inspired to say, you have this day rejected your God who himself saved you out of all your adversities and your tribulations. And you have said unto him, nay, but set a king over us. So in essence, Samuel is really rubbing it in. He's not letting them forget the whole reason that they're there and they're gathering. And this whole thing started, even though God approved it and said to give them what they're asking for, it was an act of rebellion. And he doesn't want them to forget it. Nay, but set a king over us. Now, therefore, Samuel says, present yourselves before the Eternal by your tribes and by your thousands. So this wasn't just a meeting of the leaders. This was almost akin to the kind of gathering that would happen at one of the annual holy days when they all had to come up. But no indication it's around the time of a holy day. But it is a special gathering. God commanded it through Samuel, and he said, all of you come by your thousands and in your groupings, according to your tribes and the families within your tribes. Next, then, we're going to see that Samuel will use the casting of lots in order to determine God's will for the selection of a king. Now, wait a minute. We already know he picked Saul. So what's this for? Why are we going to cast lots if we already know the answer? God already told Samuel, I'm picking him out. I'm going to send him to you. You're going to meet him on the road. He already pointed him out. He already laid hands on him and anointed him. What's this for? This is for the people. He's gathered the thousands of them together, and now, in essence, God is going to create a show, if you will, so that the people become aware that this is the divine selection of God, not just Samuel out of his own mind making a decision and picking somebody. That's what this is about. Verse 20, when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, the tribe of Benjamin was taken. Taken how? Taken what? It means they were there is the selection process now, which is narrowing down, where God is making known who the new king is going to be, and it starts at the tribal level. So there's a lot or lottery, in essence, that's going on here. The Bible scholars who don't understand it, but they have a lot of guesses, but we'll read some of their guesses. Basically, they suggest that either stones or tokens representing the 12 tribes and then the clans and the families and the individuals were placed in a container, perhaps a jar, a bag, a cloth, whatever it may be. The container was shaken or some way a stone then was drawn out or allowed to fall out to indicate the choice. So I have it in my mind. I don't know. But the idea that there is a bag with, let's say, 12 different stones, unique looking stones representing each one of the tribes, they're all put in there, jumbled around. Samuel reaches in and grabs one, and the one that comes out is divinely inspired by God to be the tribe out of which the new king is going to come. So this was approximately the way that God made his will known, because he certainly didn't utter it with his voice out of heaven. And you don't find Samuel saying, you know, God spoke to me in secret and told me it's going to be someone out of the tribe of Benjamin. God is literally allowing all of the people to see this process happen. So either Samuel was a really good charlatan, you know, who was faking this whole deal and making it come out the way he wanted, or else legitimately God was inspiring what otherwise would have been a random act by chance, and instead guiding it so that his will is actually fulfilled. And that's exactly what happened. So this process of casting lots, however it happened, the tribe of Benjamin was picked. That eliminated all 11 of the others. All right, that was phase one. The tribe of Benjamin was taken, verse 21, and when he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near, so the other ones, in essence, were moved out of the way, the entire tribe of Benjamin was placed front and center. Now the next question is, well, of all the families of Benjamin, you know, which one of these family lines within this particular tribe is going to have the new king? So we're going to narrow it down and narrow it down. Okay. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was taken. All right, I didn't spend a lot of time looking at, you know, one, we don't have any other great information even contained in Chronicles concerning the family lines, how many particular families of Benjamin. So it was Matri and how many others? And in essence, if then now we have a new lottery that takes place, how many stones are put in the bag that identify one particular family? I don't know what that is. The only thing I would stop and remind you of historically, and I'm not going to turn to it and read it, but it's told in Judges chapter 20 and 21. And if any of you remember, this was when the tribe of Benjamin was almost extinguished. Remember, because that horrific action, basically, of rape and murder that took place at the hands of the Benjamites. And the whole rest of the tribes were so incensed at what happened that they all gathered together and slew so many of the Benjamites that after the end of that, you can read it in Judges 20 and 21, there were only 600 male Benjamites left to the whole tribe. So my point is, Benjamin was already one of the smaller tribes compared to all of them. And then after that slaughter, which had taken place a couple hundred years, however, I didn't look up to reconnect how long ago that had been from this state, literally that tribe was in danger of becoming extinct because of the loss of the males. And so remember then, the tribes after the slaughter, they didn't want to see the tribe of Benjamin totally disappear. So in fact, they concocted this circumstance in order for them to take wives so that they could have children and keep the tribe going on. There were so many wrong things in that whole story. I won't go, you can go back and read that. But it was in the days when, as the end of the book of Judges says, when every man was doing that which was right in his own eyes. But I just want to remind you, the fact that God chose a king out of Benjamin, it was probably one of the smaller of the tribes, especially because they had so fewer males than the rest of the tribes, even at this period of time. Not even knowing how many had been lost in wars, you know, on the battlefields, which there were many. So we just simply cannot know. But I presume that Benjamin was a fairly small tribe. How many family lines then were there existing at this time, in which Matri was the particular patriarch of the tribe that was selected? I don't know. Anyone else would just be guessing. The other thing that I want to emphasize on this concerning lotteries. A couple of other examples of God actually using lotteries, if you will, as a way to make his will known. Now, when pagans do this, it's called paganism and occultism, where they attempt to divine the will of the gods using tarot cards or whatever, tea leaves. You know, they cast stuff out that normally would be in some random pattern, and yet they think there's supernatural powers that then make them move or handle in certain ways, or a card that comes up to tell you something. Okay? When it's done by anyone except the one true God, it's occultism, and it's an abomination. But when God does it, it's holy. When the one true God chooses to make his will known by basically putting his thumb on the scale of something that otherwise would be a random event by chance, it's not paganism or occultism at all. It's actually holy, and that's what's going on, either by the use of the lottery. Another example, and I'm not going to turn to it, in Exodus 28, verse 30, is where God commanded Moses in the creation when they were setting up the priesthood at Mount Sinai, and concerning the attire of the high priest, which was Aaron, and all of the Levites, and what was one of the attributes or the accoutrements that was given to the high priest, this breastplate called breastplate of judgment. And what did that breastplate include? It's like included slots for these two stones, and the stones had name. They were called the Urim and the Thummim. So I'm not going to read all of this to you. Go back and you can read that, where this was commanded by God. And so what was the point of this? Because it doesn't even give an explanation, except you find enough, if you search on the Urim and the Thummim, very likely they were two stones then that were attached over the heart on the breastplate of the high priest that would be used at times in order for God to make his will known. How? There's no explanation in the Bible, but what's thought is that they were stones that would represent a yes and the other one would represent a no. Put into, let's say, a bag, and God would inspire the high priest in the pulling out of one. Is the nation supposed to go to war? Is the nation supposed to do this? Are we supposed to stop? Are we supposed to go? Whatever the question may be, and the high priest, by the authority of God, when he pulled out one of those stones, would give him an answer, yes or no. So that's just a simplistic potential way that those stones were used, other than God literally speaking to the high priest at any given time, but to make his will known as the king of Israel through the priesthood. So there's just another example. You can research that on your own for God's use of this event that otherwise would be purely chance, a 50-50 opportunity, and yet God puts his thumb on the scale and creates an outcome in order to express his will. What's another example? Numbers 26:52. Let's turn to that one. Numbers 26, verse 52. Here is another use of a lottery to make decisions, important decisions, that express the will of God. What is this account about? It's about divvying up the lands in Canaan among all the tribes. Who's going to get what lands? Are they just going to say, on your marks, get set, go, and then they all rush, you know, and stake out whatever land they can get? No. God appointed the boundaries of the land ascribed to every single tribe throughout the entire land of Canaan according to his will. And how did he make his will known? It was through the use of a lottery. Let's notice, Numbers 26:52, the Eternal spake unto Moses, saying unto these, the land shall be divided for an inheritance according to the number of names. So this was before they ever entered in, and while Moses was still alive, because remember, Moses died and never entered into the promised land. So God inspired through Moses an explanation of how this was going to work, so they knew in advance before they ever got there. According to the number of names, verse 54, to many thou shalt give the more inheritance, and to few thou shalt give the less inheritance. Another acknowledgement, and you can go back and read the histories of the census that they took, there were some tribes that had a lot more people and tribes that had fewer people. And so God reveals through Moses the fact that he was going to apportion the amount of acreage of land, or hectares, according to the number of people. So he wasn't going to divide it up equally when a lot of tribes had a whole lot more families. So tribes who had more children were going to get more land to start with. And those that had fewer would get less. The intent was to make sure that every family within every tribe literally had a wealthy estate upon which they could make their livelihood for their families and become wealthy off the land. So they're all going to be treated equal in that regard. But according to the tribal boundaries, then some tribes were going to have more than others. So God says this up front: to many thou shalt give the more inheritance, to the few thou shalt give the less inheritance. To every one shall his inheritance be given according to those that were numbered of him in the census that God had Moses conduct prior. Verse 55, notwithstanding, the land shall be divided by what method? By lot. Now, God could have just peeled out from heaven or inspired Moses or later Joshua in secret and said, here's how I want you to divide it up. And then that man could come out and say, hey, God talked to me and told me, so you're going to get this and you're going to get that. And then the people would have said, what? You think they would have trusted him? They never did. So in this was another case where God actually used a lottery that was conducted in public in front of the people so they could see it with their own eyes. And God chose to use this as a way to make his will known. To many, verse 55 again, notwithstanding, the land shall be divided by lot according to the names of the tribes of their fathers, they shall inherit. Verse 56, according to the lot shall the possession thereof be divided between many and few. So whatever the details were, this was a public lottery that was selected. Apparently, it would have appeared to be at random, and yet God was the one making the outcome turn out exactly as he had predetermined it for every single tribe and every single family within every single tribe. So I just wanted to give you that backdrop because it's another example of God actually using this way to make his will known in a public environment. Another example we won't turn to is in Leviticus 16, which you'll remember is the detailed construction instructions for the high priest concerning the Day of Atonement. And so God likewise selected one critical element of the special sacrifice performed on the Day of Atonement and no other holy day was the Azazel goat separated from the goat which was to represent Jesus Christ. The one to be a sacrifice and the other one to let go in the wilderness, as you and I understand, picturing Satan the devil, who will ultimately be cast into outer darkness, but still alive. Okay, and if you look at the example in Leviticus 16, 8 and 10, how were the two goats? Because two goats who looked identical in every other means, and yet God was going to tell the high priest which one was to represent Jesus Christ as a sacrifice and which one, by comparison and distinction, will represent Satan. He did not leave it to Aaron or any future high priest in order to make that decision. God, and I'll cover this on the upcoming atonement this year, by the way, but it applies as another example of God making the selection. And however, it was done by lot. You'll find if you read verses 8 through 10, it likewise was done by lot. So was that now a case where the high priest used those stones called the Urim and the Thummim? And in some way, God then indicated which was for one goat versus the other? Doesn't give us any details. But somehow that selection was made. A what would normally be chance was actually dictated by God to turn out in a very predictable way, according to his will. All right, back to 1 Samuel 10. So we are midway through verse 21. So this lottery is taking place step by step to narrow down the outcome. When they'd caused the tribe of Benjamin to come nearby their families, the family of Matri was taken. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken. Now, it doesn't say, it appears that there were only, in essence, three. So the first one to get the tribe of Benjamin, the second one to get, narrow it down to the family of Matri within the tribe of Benjamin, and then the next one that picked Saul. How many had to be in this lottery? I don't know. How many men of that particular branch? Is it possible there was a third culling, if you will, at the family level? We had the tribal level, we had the clan level at Matre. Did we have another one that actually identified Kish among the other sons? It doesn't say that specifically. The scholars debate it. You know, it doesn't matter. But it was a narrowing down. I pictured in my mind that there was another lottery that just wasn't, you know, emphasized here in the way that God chose to write it down. That literally then, within a few number of sons under Matre, the clan head, then narrowed it down to Kish. And now you're looking at only those descendants from Kish, which then pointed us towards Saul. Maybe, maybe not. But anyway, so this is how God actually pointed out to the people. Saul was the selection. They got to all witness it with their own eyes by lottery. The narrowing down and the narrowing down in order to pinpoint Saul as the man that God selected. And when they sought him, meaning Saul, all right, they've all seen this public display of God's will. It's this guy named Saul, the son of Kish. All right, where is he? When they sought him, they were looking for him. He couldn't be found. Where was Saul? He was hiding. Verse 22, therefore they inquired of the Eternal further. So it's like instead of doing a search, they ask God. I mean, here's God with them. A lot of them must have been convinced God was a part of this assembly. He was the one directing the whole thing. God is the one who pointed out through Samuel in this lottery that it's Saul. So now they're asking God, where's this guy? Where is he? You picked him. They inquired of the Eternal further if the man should yet come thither. Is he going to show up? When are we going to see him? And the Eternal answered. I don't know how he did it. My supposition, again, is that he's not pealing out a voice from heaven so that they all hear the voice, but that he spoke to Samuel to answer the question, so that through Samuel was coming, in this particular case, the answer to their question. The Eternal answered, behold, he hath hid himself among the stuff. Now, how would you like to be playing a game of hide and seek and having God reveal your hiding place? That's kind of how I envision what happened here. He's trying to hide and get away from the public. And God is the one who reveals him and said, he's hiding over there in the storeroom. So what is this? Hiding himself among the stuff. What stuff? Likely, who knows, miscellaneous baggage, supplies, or equipment brought and compiled by the Israelites. Remember, they've all come from far and wide through all of their tribal lands in order to appear in this place. So whatever means there happened to be some storage facility full of a lot of stuff, and there's Saul trying to make himself invisible, hiding among baggage. The Eternal answer, behold, he's hid himself among the stuff. So Saul was reluctant to take on this role. Now he already knew. Samuel had already laid hands on him, told him he had been picked by God to be that king that the people had asked for. Samuel anointed him. He knew, sent him home, met him later. I get the impression, though, that the imminence of this assignment now was hitting him in a way that probably panicked him, especially because the entire nation, according to their tribes, was gathered together. And now, for the first time, you're supposed to face this. When you were just a young man with no aspirations for this whatsoever, and you're being thrust into this position, he panicked and he went and hid. So they find him. Verse 23, they ran and fetched him thence. And when he stood among the people, he was higher than any of the people from the shoulder and upward. Meaning physically, he was taller than anybody else in the whole nation. This was a tall guy. So it was kind of hard for him to hide anyway. Verse 24, and Samuel said to all the people, see ye him whom the Eternal hath chosen, that there is none like him among all the people. So Samuel is putting him on display. Publicly, he's making this announcement in the name of God. They've already seen the result of the lottery. So they're witnesses to that. Samuel now is adding his authority as a prophet and as a judge of Israel, which he had been for decades. He had the Samuel had the credibility. Saul had no credibility. They didn't know him. Most of them didn't know him. He's just this young guy. So Samuel is using his authority in the name of God in order now to present their new king to them. See ye him whom the Eternal hath chosen, that there is none like him among all the people. And all the people shouted and said, God save the king. Now everyone, elders are going to find out, not everybody. It says all the people said, God save the king. But we're also going to find out there's some who weren't saying it sincerely because they had doubts. And in fact, they had determined they weren't going to accept him at all. We're going to read that. But here, I mean, who's going to go against the crowd and the majority at this point? The ceremony's taken place. God has pointed out, if you believe God really, you know, is the one who led that lottery and not just Samuel kind of pulling some sort of a magic trick. So he's selected. Samuel presents him, said God has picked him, and they all say, God save the king. So what do we say about the person that God picked? Well, God chose a man who fit the image of a king, because he picked somebody who was very tall. If you're going to, and isn't that what human beings do? They judge by the outward appearance. That's what carnal people do. So in essence, God actually, even though it was an act of rebellion to ask for a human king, he picked out someone that would actually meet their expectation. First impressions, outward appearance. He gave them a nice looking, handsome, tall guy. He was the Hollywood star of the day. He looked like a king. And that's who God picked. He gave them just what they wanted. Well, some of them didn't want him. But isn't that always the case? Somebody is promoted to a position, whatever it may be, and you've got some who are early adopters. They are on board sincerely to support the person in that leadership position. You have a lot of others who I'd say are the wait and seers, because they're not going to assume, and they'll say it outwardly, but then they're going to hang back and wait and see what he actually or she does before they throw their weight of real support. And then you've got the secret or the not so secret absolute rejectors. The ones who say, doesn't meet my expectation, I ain't going for it. And I'm telling you, in any situation, there are all those three categories. I don't care how small or how big it is. Have I faced that? I've faced it many times. I faced it in the working world for quite a number of years, especially because of the fact that a lot of my career in insurance and finance was about taking over operations, customer service operations that were in trouble, not working well, or else startup organizations, and then having to bring them online and fix them. And so some honcho in the head office would pick me and send me in there. And what do you think was the reaction to all the people now that I'm their new boss? Oh, there are some who are like, they're Johnny on the spot to say, welcome, welcome, we're glad you're here. And then there's some who are like, make it pretty well known, they're not happy. And there's a whole lot of middle of the roaders who are waiting seers. So you have your own experiences. I just have mine. I understand the way this goes. I understand the way the carnal mind works, because guess what? I got one too. And I'm exactly the same way by nature. So every one of those natural dynamics was going on here. I guarantee you that is true. That's the way people are. Right? So it didn't matter that God picked him. It didn't matter that Samuel seconded the selection. It didn't matter that Samuel had already laid hands upon him to anoint him as king. Saul is going to have to earn his credibility if he ever does. And we're not going to cover that this time, but I'm setting the stage for chapter 11 and beyond, when we're going to find Saul first being tested, where he has an opportunity to either show the gumption that he deserves to be the king or not. Because most of the people are going to wait and see and find out. They're not going to throw their weight behind him just because somebody picks him and puts him up front. And I would tell you that it reminds me very much of the decision-making of Mr. Raymond Cole as it has to do with the church, and certainly as this little group called Church of God the Eternal. Because I remember when he picked me to be a minister back in 1996 and announced it to the church. And I think he wrote it. I know he told it to me. I'm pretty sure he wrote it to the entire church if you go back and look at the old announcement or monthly letters. But he was wise enough and experienced enough to know you can't just force somebody on a group of people. They have to earn their stripes or not. And I remember Mr. Cole saying to me, he says, I can think you're the right guy for the job. He says, I can use my power under God to ordain you. He says, but if the people will not accept you, I can't use you. Now, I can't verify that's 100% his words, but that's 100% his sentiment. I can ordain you, but if you don't earn it with the people, I can't use you. Because the point of a servant, of a minister with God's church, they have to have the trust of the people. And if you can't serve the sheep because the sheep don't trust you, how can you do the job? If the people shut you out, you're very, very limited. Oh, I could always just stand up here and give a sermon every Sabbath, write a letter. But there's a whole lot more to the job than just giving sermons and writing letters. There's personal service and interaction that happens one-on-one with ministers and with lay members. Mr. Cole understand that that was incredibly valuable, and by the way, had spent his entire ministry under Mr. Armstrong, demonstrating that kind of love and respect for the sheep. He was one who had shown how to earn that kind of respect as a shepherd. So he didn't just pick somebody, me or anybody else, and force the people to accept them and say, oh, this is, you know, thus saith the Lord, so you better or else you're going to go to the lake of fire. He was a pragmatist from the standpoint of understanding. It doesn't work in the real world unless there is a rapport that happens between leadership, between the ministry and the sheep. And if there is no rapport because the people don't trust you, you are handicapped from being able to do the job. It's just a fact. It's not necessarily the way it should be, but it's the way it is in the real world. So Raymond Cole understood the real world of the church, besides just the spiritual implication of these kind of decisions. Worldwide, and when I was a kid, they'd turn out these new, you know, seniors who had graduated Ambassador College, ordain them. They picked who they were going to send them out to local areas, and then dared the people to defy them. Even if they were idiots, and some of them were. Even if they didn't love the sheep and had no concern except to use that authority or that position to elevate themselves, but boy, the worldwide ministry was going to make you respect them no matter what. And that never works. They got to be able to earn it. And the only reason I'm telling you with all of this, departure from the thread, all the same dynamics were happening in this story. You don't get that, but it's human. And this is always real, and it's always true. All right, back to the storyline. So they said, God save the king. Okay, one happy family. Ha ha. Don't think so. But they all said it. What happened next? Verse 25. Samuel told the people the manner of the kingdom and wrote it in a book. This is really easy to skip over. This is one of many I wish God had chosen to write more. What this is really is because, remember, for the first time now, the nation of Israel was going to have a human king rather than God as their king. Which means this wasn't just going to happen, okay, we're going to anoint Saul as the king, okay, thanks everybody, go home, you're fine. No. What authority does the king have? Now, they knew before, in principle, what authority God had. All authority. He could do whatever he wanted. But now you got a human king? So what's the limit of this king's authority? What's he allowed to do? What is he not allowed to do? How does the king relate to the priests? Because there's a high priesthood. And again, we're talking about a time where the temple or the tabernacle worship was not really restored yet. But there was a priesthood. What's the relationship between the civil king now and the religious priesthood? How's that going to work? And where's the line between one authority and the other authority? And by the way, how is the king going to be supported? Okay, now you're introducing for the first time a human king and some type of a royal realm. How is that funded? By what money? Is it going to be because up till then, the only taxes that the people had were what? The tithes that went to the priests. So when the people actually paid their tithes and gave their free will offerings through the priesthood, they were paying all the taxes that they had to pay. Now, all of a sudden, because they asked for a human king, now you've got to support a human king. How's that going to work? There's going to have to be some sort of new taxation. Doesn't explain what it was. But they asked for it. They were going to get it. Unless you were going to make your king a beggar. Literally, to have to beg for the support. There was some type of system. Maybe it was going to be. What I'm doing is comparing this book that was written during this major meeting, like in the USA, our Constitution. This was literally the organization of the new government to delineate what authority the king had versus what the tribes had. There were tribal authorities. How does the authority of the tribes and the tribal leaders interface with the king now who's over the whole nation? What do the tribes get to do? What does the king get to do? And how do those authorities intersect? How is the kingdom funded? See, these are all things you can just read this story and go right over it. But there was an absolute practical consideration that had to be decided. Well, this one line tells us, Samuel told the people the manner of the kingdom and wrote it in a book. So here's a case where God inspired Samuel to understand how to write the Constitution by which all these decisions would be made for a new civil government under a human king that did not exist before, didn't need to exist before when God was their king. It was declaring the duties of the king, the limits of his power, the boundaries between kings, priests, and tribes. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have that document? Not, God didn't preserve it. Now I want you to turn back with me all the way to Deuteronomy 17. Because Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20 actually tells us a prophecy concerning these very events. So generations before, God knew this was going to happen and that they were going to ask for a human king, to their own detriment, by the way. And because this is the story of when it actually is implemented for the first time, this prophecy in Deuteronomy 17 becomes very important. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. So through Moses, this is what God wrote. When thou art come unto the land which the Eternal thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, God is saying, when I give you the blessing of entering into this land, I give it to you, and you possess it, and you live in it, and then you're going to say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are about me. Isn't that interesting? Generations before, and isn't that exactly what they did? We saw that story back in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel. God was prophesying this was going to happen. And he says, when, not if you do it, but when you do it, because you will. Verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Eternal thy God shall choose. So this is proof, even as we've read in chapter 10 of 1 Samuel, just because this was an affront to God that the people asked for a human king, and Samuel keeps reminding of that. You just slapped God in the face by asking for a human king. Don't forget it. Nevertheless, God didn't just say, well, fine, you don't want me for a king, then get your own. God was still a part of this whole process, including the picking of Saul. And every future king, by the way, for better or for worse, they were God's pick. And here was God declaring generations before that this was the way it should work. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Eternal thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. Seems pretty straightforward. Israelite nation not having truly an Israelite king. Doesn't that make sense? Used to make sense in our country too. How many representatives in Washington D.C. right now, which are ostensibly elected by the people, who have no allegiance to this country whatsoever? In fact, they were foreign born. Interesting that our government requires a U.S. president to be born in this country, but none of the other offices. So we're getting the results of that when the people think they're electing people as their representatives who have absolutely no loyalty to the people over whom they're supposed to be representing. So this principle is absolutely stated here by God. This is the right way for this to work. You select someone who, in essence, is one of your families and has an interest in you and your people, not any other foreign allegiance. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. Verse 16, but he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt. So here's two other now criteria. Why is this even becoming important? Because as soon as you have a human king, these are problems. These are tendencies. These are pitfalls. When you have God as your king, you have no such problem. Because you know God is faithful. You know God is all-powerful. He loves you. He's going to be working for you and not against you. And he's not going to merchandise you, take advantage of you, or oppress you. As soon as you have a human being in a position of the king, all bets are off. Because every single human being is a liar, a thief, and a murderer by nature. They are selfish, adulterous, and they will take advantage of you. They will take advantage. By nature, they will take advantage of the office, the power that they're given, not to fulfill the will for the good of the nation, but to line their own pockets. That's the way humanity works, which is why no human government is a blessing. No, not a single human government that has ever existed or will ever exist up until the return of Jesus Christ, which we pray for every day. Not a single one of them avoids these pitfalls. Not a single one. So they are all a curse. So, but God's laying out. He said, when you do this, when you demand a king, at least here's how to mitigate the problems that come from that. King should be one of you. And that king should not have in mind to try and multiply horses, which includes the idea of armies, to grant power in his hands, to exert his will, nor cause the people to return to Egypt. That king is still supposed to be representing God and be a godly leader who is putting God and his commandments first, not second, and not trying to take the whole nation into paganism. To the end that he should multiply horses, for as much as the Eternal hath said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. So what's one of the things that human kings do? They see a problem on the horizon. They want to make an alliance with another nation. Oh, I see a threat from this nation on one border. Let me make an alliance with the one on the other border. And now you're beholden to this other foreign nation, a political alliance, in order to get more horses, to get more power to defend yourself against whoever you think your enemies are. And how does that ever work? It always turns out bad. So the entire future of the nation of Israel under human kings, beginning with this one in Saul, was going to tell the story of failure over generations and generations and generations. Because they violated. Some did well, but they were the exception to the rule. You got the Hezekiahs and the Josiahs, but boy, were they exception to the rules, because the majority of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah violated these principles. And because of it, the people suffered. How much better off would they have been if God had remained their king? You never would have had a doubt. You never would have had to worry about whether this one's going to be a good one or a bad one. So when they asked for a king, they were asking for all of this uncertainty and ultimate curses, which God warned them. 1 Samuel 8 was going to happen. They didn't care. But here he warned them generations in advance. Verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives to himself, which is another tendency, that his heart turn not away. Solomon was going to be the one who became the poster child for that, wasn't he? Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. So not power through armies, horses, and not money for his own control. And it shall be when he sits upon the throne of the kingdom, he shall write him a copy of this law and a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. Interesting. God commanded generations before the first king would ever be on the throne, Saul, that if you want to try to mitigate the problems of having a human king, make sure he meets these criteria, does these things. And one of the commandments was going to be that every single king over Israel was literally to handwrite his own copy of the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments. So remember, we didn't have the printing press. There weren't massive copies. Everybody didn't have Bibles. You had the written law, but it was held by the priests. And so here was a command literally that the king, if there was a new king who was coronated, was to literally access the written commandments, statutes, and the judgments dictated by God through Moses, and hand copy his own personal copy of that law, and then use it and read it and refer to it as a basis for the way he would think about fulfilling his job. Pretty cool concept, isn't it? I just emphasize again, it's a substitute for the fact that when God was their king, they didn't need any of that, because he was the personification of those commandments. He didn't have to be reminded of them. He didn't have to write them down. He didn't have to fight his own carnal nature against taking advantage of the people. Now, a human king is always going to have to be guarding against his own carnal nature, if he will. He shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priest, the Levites. And it shall be with him, this physical copy of the law, which he would write with his own hand. His personal copy. And he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Eternal, his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them. Verse 20, why? That his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment. Because that's always the natural tendency. To the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. This is God's recipe for a successful human king. Always far inferior to God himself being king. But if you're going to have a human king, if the king will follow these rules, he can be successful and the people can be fairly blessed. But you let the king fail in any one of these criteria, he will suffer and the people will suffer. That is exactly what was being set up. And that's exactly what happened. All right, back to 1 Samuel 10. We're in verse 25. Samuel told the people the manner of the kingdom and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Eternal. And I suspect that Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20 was recited and incorporated into the Constitution. I bet it was. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. So this big conclave in Mizpah is ended, and they all go home. And Saul went home to Gibeah. And there went with him a band of men. Ah, so what's new? God has selected him. They didn't really have a coronation ceremony. Take note of that. That's coming. He was already anointed by Samuel. He's already now been selected in the presence of all the people through a lottery. God's pointed him out. Samuel's confirmed it. They wrote a constitution for how the government was going to work. And then they all went home. The only difference was they sent a band, if you want to say personal guards, whatever this was. For the first time now, Saul has got a new entourage. There went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched. God inspired these men with favorability towards Saul. In other words, God, in spite of their rebellion against him and slapping him in the face by wanting a human king, God picked a man who should have been a suitable king and inspired the men around him to be favorable toward him and his kingship. In other words, he did everything to set the stage for Saul's success. He's not putting him behind the eight ball to try and make him fail just because this whole thing was an act of rebellion. God is still benevolently doing everything possible for the success, including surrounding him with faithful men who would not sell him out, whose hearts God had touched. Verse 27, but the children of Belial, said, how shall this man save us? Now, wait a minute. They had all said, God save the king. How many of them now are a part of this? In other words, they were saying the words out loud, but in their heart, they were going, The children of Belial said, how shall this man save us? And they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. So what happened? Here was this contingent. I told you there were the early adopters who supported him. There were probably the greatest number of the wait and seers. And then there are the secret haters who are not going to accept him no matter what, no matter how appropriate, no matter how qualified, no matter how successful he might become. He's not our guy and we ain't having it. And that they're called now the sons of Belial, which word is translated in other translations as worthless fellows, scoundrels, or troublemakers. The scholars say they were likely a group of rebellious or skeptical individuals, possibly tribal leaders. I suspect they were tribal leaders. You know, if you just have a few malcontents among, you know, some of the people at the lowest levels of the family, so what? But I tell you where your real problem comes is when influential people who have pull and they don't get behind the selection, then you've got the potential for problems. I think that's likely what it was. Tribal leaders, elites, and general troublemakers who just want to resist anyway. Their natural result is, an authority tells me this is what's going to happen. You've got this contingent who always just wants to do the opposite. There's always that. And again, I still remind you, I used to be that way when I was young, so I understand it. You're rebellious for the sake of being rebellious. There's always that contingent. Notice Saul's orientation of mind. One, we already saw he's very meek and very mild. He didn't even consider he was up to the challenge, which is why he went ahead. They drag him out. They present him to the nation. And you've got these malcontents who aren't going to support him. But at this point, Saul's not playing politics. He doesn't even think he's up to the challenge. He responds, it says he held his peace. So he was showing humility and graciousness at this very, very, very early stage. Now you know the result. It doesn't remain that way because Saul is one who over time is corrupted in his thinking and makes horrible decisions. He starts off really, really well and he has every advantage, including God's support. And so it It reminds me, for those you know, like Star Wars, and it's like Anakin Skywalker, you know, the fair-haired guy who has everything and then ultimately going over to the dark side. That's kind of my picture of, but this story is so much better. Don't read the occultic or the movies or the stuff, you know, with Star Wars. This is the real-life historical example of the same dynamics that went very much hand-in-hand, I suspect, from which a lot of the fictional sci-fi stuff was actually copied. So this is the reality of it. The young man who had every physical advantage, but through circumstances, ultimately ends up going to the dark side. That's going to be the story of Saul. But he starts off really, really well, including manifestation of patience and humility. This spirit of these sons of Belial says that they despised him and brought him no presents. It's the very same in closing, we're going to turn to Luke 19. I don't want to read this whole parable, but it's the same spirit that is manifested among those who end up rejecting Jesus Christ. And he's the one who prophesied it. Let's see if I can read really, really quick through it. Luke 19, beginning in verse 11. As they heard these things, he added and spake a parable because he was nigh to Jerusalem, because they thought that the kingdom of God should immediately appear. This was one of the problems. They had high expectations of the kingdom of God coming, kicking out the Romans, putting them in charge. That wasn't going to happen. Verse 12, he said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said unto them, occupy till I come. So here's a king, a rightful king, who assigns servants to take care of a part of his estate while he's away on a trip. They're stewards in charge of part of his kingdom. They're accountable. And he says, occupy till I come. Verse 14, but his citizens hated him and sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. The reason I'm relating this parable, this is the exact same spirit that we're reading about in 1 Samuel 10. What the sons of Belial say, we will not have this man reign over us. Exactly the same spirit. We will not have this man reign over us, verse 15. And it came to pass when he was returned. So he goes away in his long journey, comes back. What did they do in the meantime? It depends on whether they accepted their king and his dominion over them or not. Came to pass when he was returned, having received the kingdom, he commanded these servants to be called unto him to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Then came to the first, saying, Lord, thy pound has gained 10 pounds. Well done. Okay, he goes through all these, the ones who did a good job, because they accepted his authority as king. And they did act as good stewards while he was away. So when he came back, he was able to deliver them the goods. Verse 20, and another came saying, so here's the one who said, we will not have this man reign over us. What did he do at this time in the interim? Another came saying, Lord, behold, here is thy pound. I didn't steal it from you. I didn't rob you. I'm giving you back what you gave me, which I have kept laid up in a napkin. Verse 21, for I feared thee, because thou art an austere man. Thou takest up that thou laidst not down, and reapest that thou didst not sow. And the implication is, they didn't think he had a right to rule or to make decisions or to delegate responsibilities to other people. Oh, I knew you were an austere man making us do the work. Well, you go off la-di-da wherever you were all this time, but here we're back home toiling to make money for you. That's the sentiment. We knew this is the way kind of person you were. So we didn't rob from you here. Here's what you gave us. Verse 22, and he said unto them, out of thine own mouth will I judge thee, thou wicked servant. So he uses their own words against them. Thou knewest that I was an austere man, if that's what you want to call me. If you thought I was an austere man, I was hard and not merciful or kind, and would expect of you to give me a return on my investment, why didn't you give me a return on my investment? taking up that I laid not down and reaping that I did not sow, meaning delegated to others to do the work. Wherefore then gavest not thou my money into the bank, that at my coming I might have required mine own with usury? If you'd at least taken what I gave you and put it in the bank, you wouldn't have had any hard work to do, and I would at least got some return on my investment. You gave me no return on my investment, even though you knew I was going to demand it, because I was so austere and mean and heartless. And he said unto them that stood by, take from him the pound and give it to him that hath 10 pounds. And they said unto him, Lord, he hath 10 pounds. And again, this is a parable about stewards, not about people who receive charity. He didn't give them all charity. He gave them all responsibility to increase his estate by their hard work as delegated representatives in his government. Some did and some didn't. And they said unto him, Lord, he has 10 pounds. He's already got 10 pounds, and you're giving him more. Because, yeah, he's the one that actually supports my government, accepts my lordship, and is doing a good job. So, yeah, I'm going to those who produce better, I'm going to give more. Verse 26, for I say unto you that unto everyone which hath. Why do they have anything? Because they're working hard within the framework of God's government. They're showing respect for authority, and they're actually fulfilling the obligations. That's why they have anything, because they're blessed. Unto everyone that hath shall be given. And from him that hath not, why don't they have? Because they're not following the rules. They never supported the government. They said, we will not have this man reign over us. They were rebels. So they, in fact, used their time and energies, no matter what they said, to pay lip service. Underneath, they were subverting the whole time. And God reads the hearts and minds. You can get away with that with certain human bosses. You'll never get away, and neither will I with God. He knows where we're coming from. From him that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away from him. Verse 27, but those mine enemies... This is Christ speaking. Those mine enemies which would not that I should reign over them, they never would accept that authority, bring hither and slay them before me. So Christ, our Savior, the little baby in the manger who grew up, he's the one who's given this warning. So this is the basis of judgment for anyone who wants to be in the kingdom. Do we really accept the authority of God in Jesus Christ in executing this master plan of which we've been called to be a part? Do we really support him? Do we really love him? Or are we ones that are saying, God save the king? I won't have him to rule over me. He knows. And by our actions, we're demonstrating either our heartfelt support for the coming king, Jesus Christ, or else pursuing our own way separately. So this is exactly the stage that was set by the selection of Saul. Didn't have to be if they'd kept God as their king, wouldn't have had all this drama and this politics. They asked for it, God gave it to them, and then he selected a man to give him every opportunity to succeed. But now you've got the introduction of the politics of the ones who will and the ones who will not support the crown over Israel. Next time, now we're ready to take up chapter 11, and we're going to get to see the very first opportunity for Saul to be tested as a leader when they face an outside enemy. We'll get into that next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 10th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, July 19th, 2025.